Welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Every year, it seems those stellar tourism numbers keep coming. They also bring the question of when those numbers will hit a ceiling. It's a query the Hawaii Tourism Authority has on the back burner while it continues to produce double-digit gains in Hawaii's four top markets: domestic U.S. arrivals from the East and West regions, Japan, and Canada. Despite the effort that went into getting those increases, HTA Chief George Seghetti seems a bit bemused. He's been on the job for about 2 years, a period he thought would result in a plateau or perhaps even a rollback of the arrival and spend numbers. George Seghetti dropped by our studio yesterday, and we talked about the difference in expectations and the banner year in progress for tourism.
As we went through 2016, it was supposed to be a little softer than the past years, but 2016 ended up being a really very good year, productive year for us on arrivals and spend. But 2017 was definitely supposed to kind of slow down a little bit, and that one, this first half of this year, have exceeded all arrival expectations, and just as importantly, or maybe more importantly, the spend has gone up significantly in 2017. So I think our industry is fragile, is very fragile at best. It always is. So I don't know if we've met our top number yet. I'm cautiously optimistic.
That very famous phrase. But as you look at the nexus of what's happening geopolitically and what has been happening in Hawaii with these tourism numbers that just keep finding new heights, what do you attribute our stellar performance?
I'd like to think that at HTA we kind of set the pace, but it is not our doing. Credit needs to go out to all of the stakeholders, the brick and mortar, the activities people, the tour companies. They all do a really good job in properly promoting Hawaii with the Hawaiian culture and the beauty of our natural resources. So I think it's all everybody kind of coming together with the same message about Hawaii being an open, safe, clean, and welcoming environment, and that's kind of resonated with travelers worldwide.
They've also seen and heard a lot about the fact that we have a number of homeless people that are very, very visible. Not necessarily the best thing for a tourism authority to have out there, but it's the way it is. What do you think the responsibility is of the tourism community in being able to help those who are homeless?
Well, first of all, it's a worldwide event. Everywhere I travel, it's everywhere. And maybe it's a little bit more magnified in Hawaii because we are a welcoming state. But I think it's a problem or an issue that's challenging, and it's going to take everybody coming together. I remember a couple of years ago when I was at the HLTA, we started a program with IHS in Waikiki to address that first, and that's worked pretty well. But I think it's an issue that really is going to take all of the stakeholders and private sector and as well as state and county government to work together.
Many of them believe that they are those stakeholders that you just mentioned. But there have also been fingers pointed at the tourism industry saying, hey, come on, you have a lot of stake in all of this. Why aren't you participating more? Do you think that tourism should be participating more in those stakeholder activities?
Well, I think they are. If you look at even this year, I believe the legislature has passed a bill where we'll be getting X amount of funds matched by private sector, and we'll address homelessness in particular resort areas. I think in many, many ways, you look at what the Hilton has done with their fundraising down there and their concert raising money and all going to the different organizations, IHS, to address homelessness. I think behind the scenes, they're very active, and they do a lot to address homelessness.
Looking at how much more we can accommodate in Hawaii, you mentioned earlier that we're not quite at the ceiling yet, but who knows what that ceiling might be. Meanwhile, we've been watching airlines come out with statements that they're going to be bringing more people to Hawaii, largely to the neighbor islands. Is this really a shift from Oahu to the neighbor islands in a way that we really haven't seen before?
Things go in cycles. At one time, it was all neighbor islands. It was get your Mai Tai, sit by the pool, and enjoy the neighbor islands. And it still is everywhere. But Oahu has been at capacity for a while. We still have rooms. Oahu has rooms. And what we try to do is make sure that we're identifying those shoulder periods and keeping things more steady instead of the peaks and valleys that we used to have. We're getting a more consistent visitor arrival. each island has its own unique character, its own unique activities, and I think that resonates with today's traveler that wants that really authentic experience. So you could zip line in the rainforests of Maui, or you can hike the Jurassic Park coastline of the Nepali coast. You can see the volcano. Each island has its own unique experience. All have amazing culinary experiences. So I think that's resonating with global travelers.
It's sometimes tough to just talk about a traveler, because that traveler could be a domestic traveler, could be somebody coming from Asia, it could be someone coming from perhaps Canada or any other place. And also you're talking about a difference in age and the way in which some, millennials included, may want to participate in Hawaii. Do you have any sense of what that new market is for Hawaii and how they're behaving differently in it?
Well, there's no doubt that the baby boomers got us here, and we really take care of them. They're the ones that have been coming 5, 10, 15, 20 years. They know the front desk. They know the concierge. But the millennials in Generation Z, they're a different traveler, and you combine that with technology and what it's put in there. They get on their smartphone and they get here and they go, where do locals eat? Where do locals hike? Where do locals swim? They want that authentic experience.
And they're probably staying at an Airbnb or something similar.
Well, that's technology. There's no doubt that, you know, there's still a big, the brick and mortar very, very popular, but there's the technology's thrown Airbnb and they've thrown Uber and they've thrown other things at us that we're all having to adapt to and figure out how you regulate it properly and make sure you can incorporate into your model. So the millennial traveler is definitely different than their mom and dad traveler.
Given the fact that in the last 6 months, according to your new report, we have people coming from the mainland, U.S., Japan, Canada, which has been in some ways Hawaii's bread and butter. But looking at how that has changed a little bit over this last year, in February, things kind of tanked a little bit there with domestic travelers, then came back up again. But looking at where you're really hoping to bring people to Hawaii now, with the pressures in Japan to keep people at home, very often with people who are on the mainland who are looking at their jobs and their lives a little differently now, maybe not so much in Canada. How is it that you're approaching it differently in these next 6 months and into next year?
Well, all of the markets you just mentioned, North America, Canada, Japan, Australia, Oceania, are all up. They're all up fairly significant on spend as well as arrivals, and they're up on all islands. So that's been a good thing. We have strategically tried to create more access on the neighbor islands where we have the room capacity, and, you know, we've been very successful at doing that this past year. People don't have to just come to Oahu. They can go direct flights, and that's where we're seeing a lot more direct flights from our airlines going to the neighbor islands, and you're going to see a lot more of that come in the second half of the year with United's commitment to 20% more flights to the neighbor islands. JAL is now going to fly, Japan Airlines now fly to Kona 7 days a week.
Hawaiian has said it.
Hawaiian's also doing it. Delta's going to fly directly into Kauai again. So access, the airlines are redirecting their planes to Hawaii, and Hawaii is a very desirable place right now.
If next year turns out to be a little bit less than this year and turns out to be a softer year as was originally predicted for this year, how will you change your strategy, and who do you think is your best market to be able to keep things afloat if you begin to see that different markets are dropping off?
Well, I think, as I said, the industry itself is very fragile. We saw it after 9/11. We saw it after the recession of 2009. I mean, it could go away. Anything in a worldwide event could impact us, and it could change it in a second. I don't have a switch to turn it on and off, so we stay the course and try to stay very focused on sustainability of our industry, and we will continue to do so. If it starts softening up, then we'll address that as it comes along. And it will. Everything goes in cycle. It's just a matter of time. So we're just trying to do enough things that we can, if it does happen, we have a plan in place to mitigate that, any kind of downturn.
Well, I look forward to our next conversation where we talk about that plan perhaps, and maybe it'll be a while before we have to do that. But thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me. Aloha.
George Segetti is the president and chief executive officer of the Hawaii Tourism Authority. HTA is the state's tourism agency, established in 1998 to strategically manage tourism and integrate the interests of visitors, the community, and the visitor industry. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the benefits of the biliteracy seal. Now your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're going back into history to look at the beginnings of Okole Hau, a.k.a. Hawaiian moonshine. It was produced illegally in the deep valleys and inaccessible forests for much of the 20th century, but the drink dates back to the 1780s when Captain Nathaniel Portlock showed Hawaiians how to make the intoxicating beverage from a particular root. About a decade later, William Stevenson, an escaped Australian convict, modified the fermenting process. He showed Hawaiians how to distill a mash of these fermented roots in iron tripods. After perfecting the technique, Okole Hau consumption skyrocketed and was said to be a, quote, gift from heaven. In fact, King Kalakaua loved it so much, he granted a full royal pardon to a man imprisoned for making illegal moonshine. But today's quiz has nothing to do with the drink and everything to do with the tripods. If you know their original purpose, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And as you're listening to the rebroadcast of The Conversation, we won't be taking any calls to answer the backyard quiz, but you can always call us at 11 a.m. when we're live. At graduation ceremonies across the state this year, more than 24, in fact 37 to be quite specific, seniors with proficiency in reading, speaking, and writing English or Hawaiian and an additional language were the first to be awarded the Hawaii Seal of Biliteracy. This recognition is part of a national movement that includes 27 states and the District of Columbia. The designation also reflects the growing demand for students who bring both multilingual skills and multicultural awareness to the 21st century global workplace. UH Professor of Japanese Language and Sociolinguistics, Nina Yoshimi, spearheads the Hawaii effort of the national movement to recognize biliteracy. And Professor Yoshimi is in our studio with us now. Hi there.
Aloha.
As we look at biliteracy, we've been seeing a lot of movements in schools and private schools. Earlier this year, we talked to Merino School, bringing in Chinese, other schools that have been looking at doing this or are doing it. And it seems like it's gathering steam in lots of different places. But the big end that you're talking about here is to be able to have people feel they have the ability to live and work in those languages beyond just studying them for academic sake.
Yes.
How is this movement growing in a way that perhaps we haven't noticed so much, given the fact that now 27 states are doing it?
Well, actually, Hawaii is fortunate that we got an early start on awarding the seals. Although there are 27 states in the District of Columbia that have approved the seal, that's done through the state legislatures. Hawaii, with its single school district, moved very quickly. So some are actually not even awarding the seal yet, although they've approved the legislation. Hawaii, in its first year, has Chinese, Japanese, Spanish, and English for the Hawaiian immersion students. I don't think it crept up on us. I think we are actually, because we were the 11th state entity. I think D.C. preceded us. We were the 11th to get the seal of biliteracy. I think it's that the others have seen that the front edge of the wave is moving and they have to catch up, so they're paddling harder to catch up.
Within the state?
Within the country. Within the state, I think the movement towards a biliteracy seal is actually a reflection of the recognition that our economy requires people who speak other languages, but we can no longer rely on the third or fourth generation of speakers who came over because they are no longer speaking the language. So,
We also have people coming here both to visit and to move and feeling that if they can't operate in English, how are they going to be able to live and work?
Yes. That's actually quite a significant concern for the schools who have students coming in who aren't English proficient yet. Also for the courts. Hawaii was recognized as one of the court systems that has implemented a court interpreter program, but they still have a long way to go to make sure that the court interpreter program is properly staffed with the people who are proficient enough to do those kinds of things.
Which, again, feeds back into the program
that
you've been spearheading to make sure that we do have enough people to be able to staff a courtroom and be an interpreter or any place else where it might be quite beneficial to speak two or more languages.
Yes.
Is this really moving us into a future where it will become sort of de rigueur that you have to have at least two languages in which you're proficient?
I think we're going to find increasingly that employers are looking for bilinguals. They recognize that the country is increasingly bilingual in terms of the citizenry. Even though people speak English, they frequently would rather conduct business in their first language. Basically, upper administration recognizes that speaking another language gives you better communication skills, a broader perspective on the world, and generally increases your capacity for problem solving because you have more than one way to think about a problem. And what I find in talking with employers is that they frequently are saying bilingual is a very valuable quality when we're looking for employees. All things being equal, we will always hire the bilingual.
Which could significantly add to one's attraction to a particular job if you can speak two or more languages.
Yes.
There may be some backlash to this, though, particularly now in the political climate in which we find ourselves, where the idea that, you know, America first, English first, and if you're going to come to America, well, you better learn English. How does that sync with the way the rest of the world seems to be approaching language?
Well, ironically, being America first means that you should be thinking about bilingualism and biliteracy. If you cannot speak to others about what America means, if you cannot speak to others about what we have here, what we know about government, what we know about enterprise, what we know about science and technology, people say, oh, the rest of the world speaks English. Well, some of the rest of the world speaks English, but overwhelmingly, there are many people in the world that would benefit from Americans going out and speaking to them about America in the language that they speak. So I think the idea of bilingual and bicultural is actually very pro-American because what it says is if we're a leader, we need to be able to lead regardless of what language it is we have to speak in.
What language do you think do we need to add into the complement of largely Asian languages in which we're seeing a lot of kids being taught now?
That's a good question. Asian languages have been popular in the state predominantly because of the visitor industry and also because of the heritage of many of the people who live here. I know Spanish is increasingly common across the country, and Spanish actually is increasingly common in Hawaii as well. I would say with some of the cybersecurity concerns that we have, being able, I guess, to read code, but also to be able to understand what the language is behind the code would make a language like Korean or Russian much more important, possibly even Persian, if the Iranians are involved, because actually some of the code that people write and the tricks that they do are based in the language that they come from. So the capacity to actually understand the culture and language of those countries that we have concerns about defense towards, I think would be something important.
So what does this mean for the good old-fashioned romance languages? I mean, whether you're speaking French, you mentioned Spanish a moment ago, but you know, French and Italian, German not being a romance language, but still one of the languages that was traditionally found in high schools and middle schools.
This, I think, is an interesting point. in Europe, they are also promoting bilingualism. They also understand that just speaking the language that they're born with will limit their opportunities in the workforce. So that means anybody from the U.S. who wants to work in Europe should also be thinking bilingualism for the languages that we just mentioned, French, Italian, German. The Germans are very much at the top of their game when it comes to engineering. And in fact, the University of Rhode Island has a bilingual engineering German program. And every one of their graduates gets a very fine job when they graduate. So we can tell that innovative partnerships with language and particular industry sectors would be of great benefit.
It sounds in a way, though, that that might be trilingualism, because if you grow up speaking German and you're also growing up and hearing a great deal of English and having to take on a third language, too, to be able to compete, you're really saying that we need to be operating in many languages, not just two.
Yes. And in fact, that's what happens in Europe. They have a second language well early on into their education. And by the time they graduate, those who've taken the opportunity are readily trilingual. My sense here is that, let me just say that it's always easier to learn the third and fourth once you get that initial second language under your belt. And my feeling is that actually Hawaiian provides us with a wonderful opportunity here. Many people would like to learn Hawaiian, and if that were an opportunity that were created maybe more readily available at the elementary level, that might get people more aware of what it means to be bilingual and what it gets them and how it enhances their understanding of the place where they live, and it might encourage people to continue to study that third language as they move up.
Just to bring this back to next year's seniors, incoming seniors now, how many languages will they have when they graduate?
So the next year seniors, the opportunity for testing, it's doubling. I think it's up to about 16 different languages. I actually don't have the number on on my fingertip, but it's on the Department of Education website, and it includes languages such as Korean and Hawaiian. We hope that assessment is under development. Hindi, Hebrew, and a number of others.
We'll look forward to hearing what happens as we reach the end of the year and who has what. And good luck with this incoming year of seniors.
Thank you so much. And credit to the DOE.
Dina Yoshimi is professor of Japanese language and sociolinguistics at UH Manoa and is leading the Hawaii involvement in the National Seal of Biliteracy Movement.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Chuck DeLeonardis Presents, announcing Phil Lesh from The Grateful Dead and Friends in Concert, December 28th and 29th at the MAC and New Year's Eve at Hawaii Theater. Tickets on sale August 4th.
Time can feel slow.
An hour takes forever when you're five.
Time can feel fast.
There's a lot you can capture with just a second.
Time is always changing.
You're seeing the past, you're in the present, you're thinking about the future. It's all there. It focuses us on life.
I'm Guy Raz, Shifting Time, on the next TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Saturday at 3 p.m.
A former Navy officer ensnared in the Malaysian defense contractor bribery case is now fighting back. Civil Beat reporter Kirsten Downey has today's reality check. Hi, Kirsten.
Aloha, Bethann.
This is some case. We started to talk about it back in March. We're talking about the case that involves a defense contractor in Malaysia called Fat Leonard. Kind of reminds me of Signor Ferrari in Casablanca. How is this case spinning out? I mean, with all of these people, I think, 20 or 21 of them that actually are in active cases and maybe hundreds of them who are being investigated, this thing just seems to be spiraling.
Well, it's a wide-ranging scandal. I think probably one of the worst scandals in Navy history. 200 Navy, former and current Navy officers are being investigated, and the allegations are that they accepted lavish entertainment, expensive meals, the finest wines, cognac, cigars, even the services of prostitutes in exchange for steering contracts to this Malaysian defense contractor, Leonard Francis.
At this point, with this particular Navy officer who says he's going to fight back. Who is helping him to do that?
Well, he's got a local attorney named Bernie Brevar, who is very experienced in federal prosecution cases. These are massively complicated cases. I went to San Diego to investigate what was available in the public record, and I found thousands of documents in the federal court in San Diego. Many of the records are sealed. These are the kinds of documents that any attorney that represents any of these defendants is going to have to review and be aware of in defending their clients.
So what happens to him now?
He's going to be pleading not guilty, according to Mr. Brevar, and there'll be a status hearing in September to look into what will happen to him next. He is one of nine people that were indicted in March in a case that a 78-page indictment filed by the U.S. Justice Department. So these are cases that are going to be unfolding for many months ahead.
And this is different from the Navy commander who pleaded guilty in June, right? He's already made his plea.
Yes, that's right. We have a local man who's pled guilty, and he's awaiting sentencing. He's scheduled to be sentenced, I believe, on September 11th. De Guzman is the other Hawaii man that we know has been charged. There are other people possibly pending. Who they are, we don't know. The investigation has a long way to go yet.
It certainly does, and it's going to be involving a lot more people than perhaps we even know at this point. Thanks very much, Kirsten.
Thank you so much.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org, today featuring reporter Kirsten Downey. Some people see a problem and bemoan it. Others do something about it. Steve Vinovich would fit into that second category. The trained mountain climbing instructor discovered cast-off junk, including a car, in his excursions into the gulches and the Hamakua Coast. Then he got creative in how to get rid of all that junk. He founded an ecotourism business to cover the cost of hauling it away. We spoke earlier about the turn in his professional life to teach the hiker's dictum, leave no trace.
When we started to actually hike down into these gulches for pleasure, we found that that there was a bunch of trash down there from people's households and from farms, and then the car was down there. So it just went from frustrated to sad. And so we decided to put together a team of people to get in there and clean it. And the initial team was going to be, we were going to have to pay for it. So it turns out that Gary Durego Services came in and offered his time to pull the car out. And we only had to pay for towing. And this became a really good community effort.
When a lot of people encounter trash, on occasion, people will pick up a piece and put it into a rubbish bin, or they'll be disgusted and shake their heads. When you came upon the kind of trash that you saw in the gulch, including a car, what made you think that you could do something more than just perhaps get that vehicle out of the gulch or pick up some of the trash that you saw along the way?
It's kind of embedded in me to leave no trace behind. It's a code amongst backpackers and campers and climbers that we go by. You know, you pack it in, you pack it out. And when we saw all this trash over the past few months and then the car, we just felt, you know, obligated to kind of walk the talk. So we got in there and got our hands dirty and got it done.
You talk about leaving no trace. Very often, if you're a Girl Scout or a Boy Scout, or you do scouting in other forms, that's something that you're taught as a kid. You know, you've got to make sure you clean up after yourself. And I can remember being marched around by our scout leader, just making sure that everything was as we had encountered it at the very beginning of our camping trip. Is that something that's not being passed on to kids enough now?
Well, you made a good point, because you said that you learned something as a kid and in Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, and apparently some people have learned the quite opposite, that that's okay to dump trash and to dump vehicles over the side. So it just starts from, it's never too late to learn, but it mostly starts as a child and from what we learn from our parents.
So it seems that you have an effort on two levels. One, to teach other people to hopefully teach their kids better, or maybe interact with kids directly yourself, and also to lead an effort to clean up the mess that you've encountered. What so far have you been able to bring out since your initial trip?
So these three gulches that we're working on right now are considered pilot gulches. We are basically collecting data, taking pictures and documenting everything that we find, every move that we make, and working with our councilwoman, Valerie Poindexter, and another state official. We hope to be able to create a bigger picture program to help people become aware of the problem.
Once they're aware of the problem, then do you plan to form sort of a task force of people who would be able to go in there and remove this material? And in doing that, do you also have to make a plan with the Department of Land and Natural Resources so that they're comfortable with what you're doing?
Well, the Department of Land and Resources have been very helpful, and speaking with them earlier last month, they would give me a permit on a case-by-case basis to get in there and do that. And then the other part of your question would be the task force issue. So, you know, I'm a certified climbing instructor with the AMGA.
AMGA, you mean the American Mountain Guides Association, for people who are not familiar with the acronym.
Yes, ma'am, exactly.
Okay, go ahead.
So part of my code of ethics is I just can't put people into positions that they're not comfortable with or trained to do. So part of the training would be I would train people in their community how to get down into their gulches safely with my assistance, and to get out safely, and just assess the situation case-by-case basis. So the task force would definitely consist of a team that's able and willing to go down into their gulches in their community and clean the gulches.
Any work that you have planned with kids to be able to teach them some of those skills and also some of the obligations that you feel when you're out hiking?
Yeah, so that's happening as we speak. I come across people as we're rappelling down into these gulches, and people will stop and kids will stop. But on a formal basis, I'm only one person, you know, and I'm reaching out to the community to put together a team so that we can, you know, facilitate these bigger concepts and ideas. So it's definitely a evolution in process.
Any idea about getting involved with the schools?
Well, you know, I'm all for that. I just think that from my conversations with schools is that they're a little concerned about liabilities and stuff like that. So I would be completely open to that. I would just need some sort of, you know, an in with the schools or a liaison with the schools. And again, we're not doing this for the money. We're doing it more for the community and the cleanliness of our waterways. So there wouldn't be any charge to the schools.
Well, perhaps with the schools, it's not such a matter of getting the kids to be involved with you and go out and actually do some of the things that perhaps parents might find dangerous, but to get the message across about leaving no trace, which is kind of how we started this conversation.
Yes, ma'am. That's absolutely true. There's a lot to be covered on this field and this matter, and I am open to suggestions. Again, I'm just one person here with a small team, but we're expanding. But anybody that would be willing to offer suggestions or help, they're willing to contact me.
We'll post your contact information on our Facebook page, and we wish you all the best and never to forget the power of one.
Thanks for reminding me of that.
Steve Vinovich is a trained mountain climbing instructor and the force behind Trail Rhythms, which takes tourists into the gulches to clean them of trash and cast off junk.
Aloha, this is Gavin Swain. If you like today's music, find the playlist at The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org.
Earlier in the show, we told you about the history of Hawaiian moonshine, also known as okolehau. In the 1780s, Captain Nathaniel Portlock showed Hawaiians how to make a mildly intoxicating drink from the root of the tea leaf plant. The booze was so popular, it eventually found its way to the royal table of King Kalakaua, who, out of his love for okolehau, issued a full pardon to the man brewing it illegally. The illicit brew has quite a history. In 1889, a bottle was smuggled into the World Exposition in Paris, where judges officially conferred the bronze medal to the government of Hawaii. In 1915, it took prize for excellence at a spirits competition in San Francisco. The consumption of okolehau skyrocketed when escaped Australian convict William Stevenson increased the production and the quality of Hawaiian moonshine by teaching locals to distill a mash of fermented tea leaf roots in huge iron tripots. Now, for today's quiz, we asked you to tell us the original purpose of the tripot. And if you've ever been to a whaling museum, you might have glimpsed one of those huge vats found aboard 19th century whaling ships. Those large iron pots were primarily used to liquefy whale blubber. And we had a call from Margot Vitarelli in Palolo. She worked for 9 years at the Manoa Heritage Center, where there are two beautiful examples of tripods on the grounds. It was a very popular quiz, but Margot was first and she'll get the prize. If you've got a quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Sometimes to move into the future, you need to revisit the past. At the Hawaii State Art Museum, there's a new effort by the Friends of HISAM to find support for the museum and local artists. The Friends are engaging the remaining dean of the first generation of contemporary artists in Hawaii, Satoru Abe. He's sharing the story of his early years in Honolulu, circa 1940s. HPR's arts and culture reporter Noe Tanigawa joins us now with some of that conversation. Hi, Noe.
Hey, Bethann.
Oh, to be a fly on the wall for that conversation.
Well, you would have had to be at a party because this guy, Satoru Abe, does not do a whole lot of talking these days. He's 92 years old. He said he's talked enough, in fact, too much already. But once he loosens up a little, you can really get him going. So I was so happy to be at this party at Studio Manoa. One day when I was able to catch him, because he's on a new project now. We were looking backwards to the days of the 1940s when he first started out. He was packing bottles at Dairyman's. Remember that milk delivery company that we had here in Honolulu? When one day, he said he did it maybe a year or so, and he saw the light. He decided that he did not want to do this for the rest of his life, Bethann. He was maybe in his late teens. He said, he told all of his co-workers, I'm moving to New York.
The only art that I saw was at Academy. I forgot about. Well, I took up art in high school. I was one of Shirley Russell's students.
Okay, so you just decided, I'm going to New York. Your parents supported you. Kind of crazy.
They didn't support me. I told them, I'm not worried, I'll send you money.
Oh!
I thought the street was, all you have to do is work, and there's money. But that's the beauty. Okay. The beauty is to be young, naive, and have a dream. That's all. That's all you need. You don't need skill. Skill comes from any repetition of things, okay? And the rest you can time, yeah? You can learn everything.
This guy, I mean, you don't talk to people who even talk like this anymore.
Didn't he go to school in California to learn art, and then he went to New York?
I don't believe so. I think he was here. He did go to New York twice, and this is after his first visit there.
And this is the late 1940s?
Yes,
so we're talking about when there was a sort of big movement into abstract expressionism, and
exactly.
All of that was changing the way people looked at art.
And to think that people in Hawaii were noticing it, and I understand there was kind of a beatnik culture here in the late 40s, early 50s, and that's kind of the culture that Satoru and his friends were kind of, cluing in with here. I mean, but it's still the same today. Kids leave here. They go to Seattle. They go to Portland, New York City, Brooklyn, San Diego, L.A. to pursue their art dreams, and that's what he did. Okay, he was there a couple of years. In 1950, he was back in Honolulu and got a show at the State Library. Some of his paintings had nudes in them, so therefore they nixed that show, and his pieces were shown at Takeo Gima's gallery. Gima's art gallery is probably the only one that people remember from the old days of the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And he, at that time, it was at the corner of Beachwalk and Kalakaua. He held an opening for Satoru Abe for that show, and that is where Satoru said that he met Bunpei Akaji, just got back from Italy, Tadashi Sato from Pratt, New York. Sato did that incredible mural at the Capitol. Bob Ochikubo was back from the Chicago Art Institute. Gerald Okimoto from the Honolulu Academy. Isami Doi was back from Columbia in New York City. So this is the core of Hawaii modernist painting and sculpture.
The brain trust.
it was right here. And here are these local guys. Listen to how they talk. And these are second-generation people off the plantation, most of them, okay? And think about King Street. We kind of still have the low buildings there. The architecturally, it's very similar to where these guys were hanging out.
Bunpei and I, especially, we're going to open a rent studio in Molili by Kuhio Grill. And Babo Chikubo and Tadashi going to have a gallery, Central Pacific Bank today on King and How Old Street, I think.
Oh.
Every night about 9 o'clock, they would come. They would paint through the night and come. So we end up at Kuhio Grill, which is 3-4 doors. And we order the first round of beer, and that's it. Miya-san going to take out all the beer, and the chef going to take out all the so-called leftovers, right? Bunpei one day goes, say, oh, there's a house for rent after this June, so we're going to rent that house on Metcalf Street, you know.
That became the famous Metcalf Chateau, where Hawaii modernism incubated for that summer. 1950. But, I mean, he's talking the color of these guys. They hung out together, like how people hung out in New York City, yeah, in those bars.
Yeah, but it's sort of, you know, the Hawaiian version of the salon culture taken into a bar.
Exactly. And they order beers, and the old culture here is, you know, poo-poos were free. Hello, everybody. Poo-poos used to be free. They just came with the drinks. People realized you needed to have a little joy with your alcohol. Anyway, a lot of color in that period. Satoru Abe, very successful today. See his paintings and sculptures in front of First Hawaiian Bank downtown, airports, colleges. Everything he touches turns gold these days.
And those who are at High Sam are hoping that he's going to help them bring in a little gold for what's happening at the museum, to be able to not just keep the culture going, the culture of art, but to be able to revivify some of it in a way that
We can all participate in today.
And that he enjoyed.
I know.
Make it accessible to a lot of people who sometimes think that art is something for somebody else.
You're so right. So this guy, okay, he's 92, took the lease on the shop at the...
At 92.
Okay. But then he realized maybe this is kind of a big job. So here's where the next chapter comes in, okay? Beth Ann, it's so fun to talk to you about this. I could never put this into a story on a news show. Okay, look, he got one of his collectors, Joyce Okano, former regional vice president of Chanel, to agree to be the head of Friends of High Sam.
He tapped a good one.
I did. And, you know, with her experience in retail and high fashion and all of this, she's invited some people onto the board, and they're really trying to make that shop in High Sam a place to crow about, a place to go to find art. And I don't know if you've been to the cafe there. It's the new Artisan Cafe. It's run by MW. And they've got on the walls now, there will always be a show going on. Right now, it's Yvonne Chang. You had Yvonne in recently.
I was there about a month ago, so I've missed some of this transition to how the shop is now developing and what's happening also with the Artisan Cafe. But a place that sometimes, unless you know it's there, you don't know that it's there because you've got to walk into the building. And
the food is great.
Well,
and the atmosphere is lovely.
But what's really great about this whole story is the fact that they're bringing back someone who has such interest in this and to be able to capture some of his passion and his way of looking at life and at art and to be able to make it really accessible in ways that sometimes we don't see.
You know, looking at art, you said the crucial words because the gallery shop is different now. You know, it doesn't have the keychains and the refrigerator magnets that there were before. I mean, it's really pared down.
It's an art space.
It's through a partnership with the people with Travis and Allie from Maury and Art and Flea. And they're bringing their aesthetic and the incredible makers that they've been in touch with for the last decade here in Honolulu to bring their wares into the shop. And they've redesigned it. It looks really different. It looks... It makes you look closer at things. Isn't that a funny thing? I mean, we're going to have to look differently at things in order to consume differently. And I remember, Bethan, I was sitting here one day when you had the guy who was talking about king tides, and you asked him, what's the thing that people can do to most contribute to the keeping this advance of the tides coming on? And he said, stop buying stuff. He said, just stop consuming all this stuff. Choose what you want carefully, get it, and love it. That's the way to do it at the High Sam shop.
I hear you say, curate your stuff.
Yes, exactly. It's going to be more fun. You're going to get more out of it. And I've learned from the local food movement, the cheapest is not always the best.
That's right. And of course, a lot of people in Design 2 Less really is more, but you've got to be willing to take a lot away to be able to see what's
to
really
see it.
There. Yes, I'll be doing that very soon. Thank you for the reminder. Noe Tanigawa, always fun to talk to you. Noe Tanigawa reports on arts and culture. You can hear a lot more of her conversation with Satoru Abe on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, I'm Neil Milner. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or at Google Play.
I just didn't know which was my soulmate animal. Until I was in sixth grade, when I finally discovered that it was Drosophila melanogaster, the common fruit fly.
Join us for more true stories told live. This week, pets, pine trees, adoption, tricycles, and a silent retreat. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday afternoon at 2, following This American Life.
And now we're at the time in the program where we take a look at some of the activities going on around the state that might be just a little under the radar, maybe like under your radar, but not under the radar of Derek Malama, who keeps track of such things. Hello there.
Hello.
And for the first one that you're going to talk about, something for the politically inclined.
Yes. You can meet with one of Hawaii's representatives in Washington, D.C. tomorrow night in West Oahu. Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa is holding a town hall at the Kapolei High School cafeteria. She'll give you an update on what's happening on Capitol Hill and answer your questions as well. Once again, that is tomorrow at 6:30 in the Kapolei High School cafeteria, and it's free.
And for those who know that really it's what happens at home and in our relationships that makes life enjoyable or not.
Yeah, well, you can keep them healthy, try to keep them healthy, and learn how to keep them healthy at a workshop for anyone, you know, struggling with difficulties in a relationship. Andrea Pro believes common relationship problems can be solved through education, and she'll teach skills to focus on what she calls the power of self-connection. It's tomorrow at Trunk Trailers on Kauhola Street, and this is happening in Kailua Kona at 6 p.m. tomorrow, and it's free.
Well, if you're a visitor or a new resident of Maui, you might not know about this event that's happening on Friday, but you're going to tell us.
Yes, I am. The Wailuku Town Party on this first Friday coming up presents Uptown Get Down 9. The event changes there every month. Of course, Friday night's event is highlighted by a 2-versus-2 b-boy battle. And you can find out what that is this Friday night. Market Street in Wailuku will be closed at 5:30, and the town party starts at 6 at, as part of the Wailuku Town Party, and it is free.
It's going to be a good time. Thanks very much, Derek.
You're welcome.
Maybe you might need one of those good times come Friday.
Yeah.
We'll talk about more events happening under the radar when Derek comes back on Friday. Every day he joins us to let us know some of the events that we might miss that might be indeed under the radar. And we're coming up to the top of the hour, and that's going to do it for us for today. I'm going to be away for a few days, and so Neil Milner will be sitting down for Town Square tomorrow. His guest is HSTA President Corey Rosenley. They'll be on Town Square to talk about the ESSA and the start of the new school year. In the meantime, and as always, we like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you want to get a hold of me, I'm at BKOZHPR. If you missed any part of the show or you'd like to hear something else again, you can find it all on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics, all kinds of good things. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Join Neil Milner tomorrow for Town Square.